Welcome to our discussion segment on Fulfilling His Destiny. I'm John Streeter.
And I'm Joe Parker.
Let's get started. And we're back. Part two.
Part two, yes.
All right, let's dive right in. Winston Churchill was famous for his naps during World War II. Tell us about that.
So he would start his day at 6:30 a.m., 6 a.m., and he would work intensely until about 2 or 3, and then he would have a nap. And then he would take what he called the second day in the same day, and he would work until about 3 a.m.
Mm-hmm. And his naps were, he completely went to bed. He got into his pajamas, took a shower,
shut
took
the curtains,
a bath, everything.
All that, yeah. So he would have that nap in the day, and that prepared him for the night. Now, his staff didn't always have a nap. So they would start at 6:30, sometimes work until 2 or 3 a.m., and obviously be just shot.
Yeah.
Many times, staffers would be asleep in the map room on the floor. His drive was just unmatched by anyone.
Mm-hmm.
So it was actually kind of brilliant because he actually did get two work days into a single day.
He got like, a day and a half out of a single day or 2 days worth of?
Yeah.
I remember a story in, I think it's in Walking with Destiny, but it's certainly in his memoirs, that Admiral Bertram Ramsey, who is the guy who's in charge of Operation Dynamo, the deliverance at Dunkirk, later in the war as he's rising the ranks, he's in the map room. And he tries to do what Churchill does, but he doesn't actually fall completely asleep during his nap. And so by about 10, 11, midnight, he's like dozing in his chair as Churchill's discussing the war. But he says, all I had to do was tap him on the shoulder and he was awake and he knew every detail. He was exactly, you know, what we needed. Yeah. But I just, the image of this man who has literally saved 500,000 almost Allied lives is just sitting there dozing in his chair.
Yeah.
I love it. I want to talk very briefly, knocking out some quick questions here at the beginning, very briefly about movies. I typically, when it comes to Churchill and a lot of biography movies, I'm not a huge fan, but Darkest Hour, was that pretty accurate? Came out 3-4 years ago. I assume you've seen it.
I have.
Okay. Was he actually considering giving up?
No.
Because that was the biggest thing that a lot of people had against Darkest Hour, that it seemed...
Halifax was wanting to give... Not give up, but talk to Hitler about quitting.
And so Churchill did not.
Churchill was actually ticked off about the very concept of quitting. As he said, the only thing that is left for us is to die in our own blood, if that's what it takes. So yeah, that part was inaccurate.
Was there an actual conspiracy between Halifax and Chamberlain to bring Churchill down?
Chamberlain was actually a fan of Churchill after Churchill started to take the role.
Okay.
He was very impressed, actually, by the intensity that Churchill brought to being a PM. So I don't think so.
Okay.
I think Halifax was an appeaser, and he thankfully did not become PM because it was between he and Churchill, and he turned it down. It would be a different world if Halifax had been the PM.
Yeah. It's good that he was just shipped off quietly to be the British ambassador to Washington, get him as far away from the war effort as possible. Okay, and then last one about Dunkirk and that whole early period in the war. What was his day-to-day experience during that crucial moment as France is falling? You know, he's been going back and forth for a few weeks. He's trying to prop up the sagging, bloated French government that is just itching to surrender. And now he's basically, all right, France is going to fall. We have to save the army. What were those experiences like in those days of Operation Dynamo?
As methodical as he could make them.
Okay, so not panicked. He was
maybe
focused,
controlled,
determined.
Panic.
Yeah,
because I mean France was falling, and
right.
he knew that there was nothing he could do. I think he knew it was done when he saw the lack of will not on part of the French people,
right?
But on part of the French generals in the armies. I mean, literally shrugging, like I don't know, none. He was just shocked. It's just unbelievable.
Yeah.
And so I think he knew in his mind that we're done here. There's nothing else. And that's why actually in the end, he did not send them some planes or the air power that they sent weren't stationed in France and so on. So I think when it came to Dunkirk, his job was to get the forces off of the beach as fast as he could, knowing we're leaving behind thousands of tanks, ammunition, arms, like a bunch of supplies. The importance was the men. You can always build more equipment, but if you lose an experienced soldier, that's a huge, huge problem, which Stalin ran into when Hitler tried to invade, when he actually invaded Russia.
Yeah, we'll get to
him in a minute.
Yeah. Do you think, you mentioned the planes that were not sent, do you think that they would have made a difference in France?
No. There was no, France there was had done. To be a will on the French government to fight back, and there just wasn't.
Okay. And except Charles de Gaulle.
Charles, well, yeah, he did have a will to fight back.
He did.
Yeah, absolutely did.
But he was in the minority. Tell us a little bit about Churchill's relationship with de Gaulle, because de Gaulle is head of the Free French Forces. He is the symbol of France still resisting, but Churchill was not his biggest fan.
So Churchill was an admitted Francophile. He loved the French people. He loved France. He was fluent in French. He was...
Kind of. Not
he
really.
He fancied himself fluent in French. So as...
Ask
so,
Louis Spears how...
Yeah, yeah. So as a fan of the French people, he obviously supported de Gaulle and to the extent that de Gaulle wanted to fight back. Mm-hmm. Now, the relationship, because de Gaulle was so pro-French and less pro-England... less pro anyone else but France, the relationship became strained. And actually, one of the best exchanges I heard about how strained it got was one of the members of Churchill's war cabinet commented to Churchill saying, I believe de Gaulle thinks he is the reincarnation of Saint Joan.
Meaning Joan of Arc.
Yeah. Churchill's response was, yes, but my bishops won't burn him. He contacted the headquarters where I think it was in Hampstead, right? Where de Gaulle was stationed. So he called there and he told de Gaulle's staff, like, hold you personally responsible to contain the monster of Hampstead. You are to contain him. And so it was very demanding, very entitled.
Yeah.
Even though the English were supplying him with everything.
Wasn't that partly Churchill's fault because the British attacked and sank a large portion of the French Navy at Mers El Kabir right after the fall of France?
I don't know if it was Churchill's fault for de Gaulle to act how he was acting.
Yeah.
I know that action was one of the hardest of the war.
Yeah.
And it was the result of the French armed forces not taking the action that they needed to take to get the fleet out of there. He said, take it to Canada. Go somewhere else, just retain your fleet. But he knew that the Germans were going to commandeer those ships and they would have to contend with now experienced German commanders at sea if they didn't sink them.
Yeah.
He told the English admiral, like, I'm giving you one of the worst tasks of this war, probably of all time here, because you have to attack our ally.
Yeah.
To answer you, I don't believe that it was directly influenced by that. I think de Gaulle was de Gaulle. And just had that mindset.
All right, let's talk about the Battle of Britain, because that was Churchill's and Britain's finest hour. Did Churchill create the British never give up spirit that existed during the Battle of Britain, or did he strengthen something that was already there?
I think he strengthened something that was already there.
You think that the British people were already like, no, we are not giving in to this monster. And Churchill just kind of mobilized, as Halifax put it, the English language, and sent it into battle. His words strengthened what they already had in their hearts.
Yes. And I just want to add to that, how many people in the history of the world have ever wanted to be conquered? How many of them have wanted a leader who would have said that we are going to be beaten?
Yeah.
We need to lay down our arms and quit. How many people actually want to hear that? How many people want to hear, this is the long, dark winter, or there's nothing we can do except come together and quit?
Yeah.
Who wants to hear that? No one wants to hear that. No one believes that. Truly, in their heart of hearts, no matter how downtrodden you are, you don't want to say, I will lay down and die and surrender to someone who has the intention to oppress me.
That I will give up my liberties.
I will give up my freedom. And so he touched on something that I think is innate in all of us. As for the British people at the time, they had nothing. There was no logic behind hope. There was no reason for them to stand up and say, come on then, bring it on. Mm-hmm. We want you to come. But he reminded them of who they were as English people, of their history. He drew upon their past.
Mm-hmm.
And he reminded, like, we have survived to this point. He invoked the Armada that tried to invade. He invoked all of these past conflicts that England had survived, said, this is your lineage. This is where you came from. And the fortitude and the resolve that existed there exists now.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I think that the words he used were specific to the time. But again, going back to the example, like, how many people wouldn't want to hear that?
Yeah. There's a lesson in there for other groups of people at other times in history when it seems like, you know, there's this nigh insurmountable obstacle, that we remember who we are and where we came from and the victories of the past and the triumphs that our ancestors have won. We can overcome this as they overcame that. For a second, I've got to, you know, pick up my political hat that I lay in other rooms when we do this, but to read something like, "We shall not flag or fail, we will go on to the end, we shall fight, we shall fight, we shall fight, we shall never surrender," to go from that, and then to hear so many world leaders, not just here in the United States, but around the world, saying, you know, we really have to hunker down, we really have to, we'll tell you when you are allowed to live your lives. And I just think, what would be our response if we had a leader like Churchill to this global pandemic to say, no, we are not going to surrender our freedom. We are not going to surrender the precious moments that we have with loved ones, with friends. We are going to take precautions, but we are going to live our lives. The British people, their cities were burned to the ground in 1940. And because they had a leader who said, we will never surrender, they fought back. Now, the British people are cowering in their homes because of, yes, a dangerous virus, but they have surrendered every bit of the freedom that their ancestors fought and died for in the Second World War. And it is unbelievable to see what's happened in Britain, in the United States, in France, in Germany, in countries around the world that are supposedly free, but have given this up willingly, despite the fact that their ancestors fought in this gigantic war for the very freedoms that they have now surrendered. Okay, I'm stepping off of my soapbox.
I think,
but man, that angers me.
I feel the same way. And this is a definite what if Churchill had to handle this. I mean, I can.
Wouldn't that be interesting?
Well, I mean, I think that there would have been an acknowledgement of how serious it is.
Of course, because it is serious.
And the measures by which the government should take and individuals should take to avoid getting sick.
Mm-hmm.
But then what is life apart from each other?
Yeah.
What is life without the relationships that we have, without the freedoms we have? Why is it so simple to exchange safety
for freedom?
For freedom. Freedom to have relationships with others, to speak out, to have opinions, to do any of these things that would go against a popular narrative that, as it has evolved, has sought to oppress people's viewpoints, their freedoms, and dictate their actions.
Mm-hmm.
Is that life?
Yeah.
And I think that Churchill would say, absolutely not. That is not the response that we would have, that we should have, or that we will have.
Yeah. And I think that Boris Johnson, this man who claims to be a Churchill scholar and who styles himself as, you know, the new Churchill in 2019, as he was ascending to the premiership in the UK, everyone was like, oh man, it's going to be a new Churchill. He's going to lead us through Brexit. He's going to lead us to this.
Which he did, but
he has been exposed as nothing more than another petty tyrant, because he is locking people in their homes. His government, a conservative government, so-called, is locking people in their homes.
Yeah.
Churchill would be ashamed
that
you, Boris Johnson, calling you out, I'm assuming you're not listening, but if you are, Churchill would be ashamed of you.
I mean, he'd be ashamed of the Americans. I mean, he had
absolutely
a very high opinion of us, and our free spirit is just like our ability to be free. And just one final comment. There was, I think in one of the debates, actually, there was a comment made. It was really quick. But one of the candidates said, above all else, Americans want to be safe. Wrong. That is not what they want. Americans and people on this earth want to be free. That is what they want. And yes, part of the government's job is to ensure that those freedoms are maintained. But no, people want to be free. And their safety is obviously in the forefront of their mind, but their freedom to exercise safety or not is before that. And so that is something that I think aligns with what we're talking about. And again, big the what if here, but I mean, like, how would Churchill handle current things?
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about Joseph Stalin and the monster.
The walking toddler.
No, that's Churchill.
No, Churchill's the actual walking toddler who threw tantrums.
Well, yes, he did.
Yeah.
It goes without saying that Stalin was a monster comparable to Hitler, if not exceeded by Hitler in terms of sheer body count. Why didn't, for a couple questions. First, why didn't he believe the warnings that came in the weeks before Operation Barbarossa that, hey, the Germans, they're going to attack you?
So he didn't trust anyone. He was a paranoid...
Lunatic?
Lunatic is the word, yeah. So he was very paranoid. Anything that Churchill said, he believed that Churchill was a street thief.
Is that tied vagrant. To why he was because he was involved in the effort to suppress the Russian Civil War early on?
I don't know that.
Okay.
What I do know is that no matter what conversation Winston Churchill had with Joseph Stalin, Joseph Stalin always said, if you turn your back on him, he will steal your watch.
Really?
He will steal your watch. Like there's a recorded rant which involved him literally jumping up and down like a little toddler.
Huh.
Like saying, he will steal your watch. He will steal it. He is like, and then he talked about FDR and being like, but he goes deeper. He won't just steal your watch.
Even though Britain and the United States are literally keeping the Soviet Union in the war.
The only reason why they prevailed at Stalingrad was the constant support from the UK. And
also the weather.
And the weather. Well, I mean, even with the weather, would they have fallen before winter if the supplies hadn't been in abundance?
That's true.
So yeah, even with all that, Stalin did not trust Churchill. He did not trust FDR. He had no trust for anyone.
So when Churchill and Stalin met for the first time, was that paranoia evident, or was Stalin two-faced enough to make it seem like, oh yes, I'm very
glad that
you're...
Paranoia was evident. It was. So the first night that they arrived, Winston Churchill's assistant...
They arrived where? Which was this in Moscow at their first meeting? Okay. Yeah.
He reminded Churchill, like, hey, everything in here is bugged. Let's just assume that, okay? And so he's like, thank you for reminding me of that.
Yes.
So they would have 15-course meals into the night, 3 a.m., arguing. In 1 minute, Churchill would believe that he's getting across to Stalin and be like, hey, we can't open a new front here because we're doing this instead.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the logic behind it. And he didn't have to do this, but he wanted to deliver the news in person and try and explain what was going on, not because he needed to explain himself, but because he wanted to retain Stalin as a, quote, ally. And so 1 minute, Stalin would be amiable and agreeable, and then the next, just fly off the handle and say, you're a liar. You know, or
really?
They would end an evening in a positive way. Churchill would go to bed and be like, oh, that was beneficial. And then the next day, it would be the exact opposite. It would be like, you are obviously lying, and just in effect calling the English cowards.
Really?
Maybe you'll for once run into some Germans, you know, making those statements to Churchill, which incensed him.
Now, granted, the Russians were fighting on a slightly larger front than the...
Substantially larger. Yeah. Yeah. And they were encountering many Germans.
Yes.
One of his aides, the same aide who reminded him that where they were staying was probably bugged, reminded Churchill that, you know, Stalin doesn't come from the aristocracy.
Mm-hmm.
So he does not...
He's a peasant.
Yeah, he's a peasant who worked the plow. You know, he doesn't have your education. And Churchill said, well, he openly insulted me. He's like, I know, we're bugged. Everything's bugged here. just FYI. Just
calm down.
Even though he didn't come from the aristocracy, there were a lot of people in other positions around the world who also didn't come from the aristocracy and somehow didn't become mass murderers. So, I mean...
Harry Truman.
Yeah.
Perfect example.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So, it's a very long answer, but Stalin was continuously paranoid, trusted no one, would fly off the handle. Churchill knew he was a monster. Now, I will say, the English government was not aware of what the Soviet Union did to Poland at the time when they had their first meeting.
Right.
And the thing I'm talking about is the massacre of Polish officers.
At Kachin, yeah.
Yeah, it was mass graves, everything else. So he was not aware of that at the time. Now, he did become...
But they were aware of the Holodomor, the famine that killed 7 million Ukrainian peasants. They were aware of collectivization.
Yeah, I'm not...
I mean, Churchill... No, I understand that. I mean, and Churchill asked Stalin about that, about, you know, how difficult was collectivization. And Stalin's response was, oh, that was horrible. And he just dismissed it with a wave.
Well, it's interesting when Churchill did talk to Stalin about the Polish discovery of the mass graves, he shrugged it off.
Turning to the battlefield, Churchill had a reputation for firing generals. Now, he didn't have a reputation for murdering generals like Stalin and Hitler did, but I'm thinking specifically in North Africa. He went through three different commanders. You started with Wavell and then Auchinleck, and then he landed on Montgomery. Why did he latch on to Montgomery as the man who was going to deliver Britain from the Nazis on the battlefield when it was evident to anyone who looks at, you know, the who compares Montgomery to certainly some of the American commanders like Patton, but even some of the other British commanders, that he was inferior to them. Why did he latch onto Montgomery so much? Was it simply because he happened to be in the right place at the right time and won at El Alamein?
I think, yeah, that's oof, part of it. I mean, but okay.
And Montgomery got a lot of people killed who didn't need to.
Well, he continued to have them killed, right? Not have them killed, but he continued to get them killed.
Yeah.
He's
so stinking slow.
Yeah, he was slow. He was overly cautious. He was all those things. So I'm going to give an answer, but I kind of want to do what we did in our...
Yeah, you have one left.
Yeah.
From last week.
I'm going to draw. He went through generals in the North African campaign because all the generals were overly cautious and none of them were doing anything.
Mm-hmm.
Auchinleck, he actually felt very bad about demoting him.
Yeah.
To the point where he said, we need to reuse this guy. I feel really, really...
And he did. And yeah, Auchinleck served well in the Pacific. Did.
But no one was making any attempts to advance against Rommel.
Yeah.
I mean, it was constantly pushback. And so when Monty, who Churchill acknowledged was a arrogant...
Jerk.
Yeah. Because he was just an arrogant jerk.
Yeah. And kind of like Patton.
Yeah, yeah. But he had won. He had won a decisive victory against Rommel and then continued to push Rommel's campaign back.
Do you think Churchill knew that Rommel only had two tanks left after running into that minefield at the Second Battle of Alamein, and that's why Montgomery finally started moving? Or do you think that he was in London saying, wow, we've got a guy who's actually moving, who's taking risks, even though there was no risk. Rommel's army, the Africa Corps, was annihilated at the Second Battle of El Alamein, the turning point battle there. What was his level of insight into what's actually happening on the ground?
He wanted to know everything happening on the field. And I think, though, even with that information, he was so satisfied with the wins that were occurring that he was just like, I don't care how you're doing it, just continue to do it.
Okay. So his
Feel free to correct me on
that's absolutely right. So his relationship with Monty was entirely because Monty had been in the right place at the right time.
At the right time.
Yeah.
Now even with Monty at the right place at the right time, it took him forever to actually do something.
Yeah.
And even Churchill was going to be like, come on, you know. So,
It's key to note that Montgomery was actually not his chosen replacement.
Yeah,
at the
his
Eighth
chosen
Army.
Died in a plane he crash died in, on the Lord. Way.
Replacement died in a plane crash, and then Monty was like, well, okay, I guess he's next. But yeah, Harold Alexander was a far superior general, and had he been given the Eighth Army, he would have wrung a victory out of Rommel much sooner, I think.
Yeah.
You mentioned the channel run of two German warships, the Scharnhorst and the Gneisenau, and it kind of, I don't want to say it was out of place, but it was kind of like you're talking about these big, broad themes, and then all of a sudden you focused in on that channel run. What was the impetus behind that? And tell us a little bit more about that moment in the war.
It was a little bit, the reason why I picked that is because it was, Churchill had been building up the English people to say, hey, no one's going to come near our island. Like we're going to stand and fight. And then this incident where German warships got so close to Britain without sustaining any damage. If they had sustained damage, it would have been a little bit different.
But, I think they were bombed.
Yeah, but they...
But they weren't sunk.
They
right.
weren't
yeah.
sunk, and the if they did sustain damage, it was minimal,
mm-hmm.
which was unheard of. Like, what Britain could do was reinforce their shoreline. They could embed guns. They could have patrols running. They could do all of those things.
And but they didn't.
Yeah, and especially in the channel.
Yeah.
And so for something to pass that close, it was just embarrassing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that hit... kind of that hit the morale of people when they finally learned about it. But it just made Churchill angry because he's receiving reports of all of these placements of guns and ships and patrols. And the idea that they could do that channel run was just crazy to him.
Yeah.
And so it seemed to me to be a low point for him because he was just so shocked. He was not in the habit of hanging up on people. And he hung up on the admiral who gave him the news.
I'm sure that was an awkward few seconds, like, oh no, the PM just hung up on me.
Yeah.
I am clearly going to be sent to the Arctic Circle to command the British garrison in Iceland, I think.
I think part of it too, and again, open to input here for sure, but there was no pursuit. There was no active pursuit. They may have gone after them a little bit, but what was the apprehension there? You just crossed within sight of our shore. and we didn't go after you. Yeah. That's why Churchill was like,
and the Dover batteries were right there.
Yeah, like, why?
Yeah.
Why? And he just, I don't care. Just hung up. So yeah. I picked that out because it was a particular low point I saw among others. And it just stood out as something that reminded Churchill how far they had to go.
Mm. I know from reading his wartime memoirs that Churchill got a little frustrated with Roosevelt towards the end. And this ties into the Yalta Conference, which is our next big topic. But can you explain the gradual evolution of the relationship between Churchill and Roosevelt and what role Stalin played in kind of trying to separate the two of them? Because like at Yalta, Churchill wanted to be involved in all the meetings between Roosevelt and Stalin. And Roosevelt on a couple occasions said, no, I'm going to meet with Stalin on my own. And we know now it was to discuss how to decolonize the British Empire. Stalin and Roosevelt were working together to kind of push Britain out of certain colonies in the Third World.
I think part of the root of it was that Churchill believed that he was aligned fairly well with FDR. And there was the reality that FDR had his own agenda outside of Churchill. And so I think that caused some problems, especially when Winston realized that to be true.
Mm-hmm.
And he wasn't aware of what some of the things that FDR was talking to Stalin about. I think it was just kind of surprising. That's a simplification.
No, that's...
But he thought they were in a place where they actually weren't.
Yeah. And it tallies with his statement. I forget at what point it happened during the war, but someone asked him about, you know, the fate of the British colonies after the war. And he said something to the effect of, I have not become prime minister of Great Britain in order to preside over the liquidation, the ending of the British Empire.
Yeah.
So he's going to try to hold on to these colonies. So it makes sense that Stalin and Roosevelt are kind of working together to kind of gently ease the British out, because both the Soviets and the Americans have economic and political interests in the decolonized Third World.
Yeah.
Setting up, of course, the Cold War. So tell us a little bit more about the revisionist myth that you mentioned at Yalta. I just want to be super clear on what it is, because from the podcast, it sounded like there was no Soviet advantage at Yalta and going forward.
That was not the intention of the statement.
Okay,
because the Soviets did gain an advantage. But
because they had spies all over the Roosevelt administration.
They absolutely did. But you have to connect what the spies were doing with the conversations and what was achieved at Yalta.
Okay.
And so I think that there was a disconnect there. Stalin, the way that he conducted himself and the way that he managed almost everything, from the murdering of all of the war generals that had actually had combat experience to his paranoia, there wasn't a lot of proof, in my opinion, mm-hmm. that he was this great strategic mind that would think ahead far enough to decide, I know what I'm going to do here, and I'm going to enact these things, and they're never going to know. I think that when it came time to invade Poland or take control of Poland, he just did it. It's like, okay. Yeah.
Put us in London on VE Day. 6 years of the most devastating war in human history, 2 years of fear, of bombings, 6 years of loss and heartbreak. What happened once it was announced that Germany, the great enemy across the channel, is done?
Just pure joy. Streets filled with people, parades on every block, just the masses of everyone who had suffered, realizing that the horror was over, mm-hmm. that there was not only no invasion, but there was no terror over in Europe, that something impossible, seemingly impossible, had occurred, that they had not only survived, but they had prevailed.
Mm-hmm.
So seeing the pictures of the people filling the streets, just partying all day and all night, celebrating something that was just impossible, that was unthinkable, even a few years earlier, I cannot imagine that.
Mm-hmm.
How would you describe it?
Yeah, I mean, pretty much the same way. Just an overwhelming national outpouring of grief and joy and mourning and just all at once. I mean, the statistics on VE Day in London are unbelievable. London's a pretty big city,
mm-hmm.
but 1 million people were outside Buckingham Palace and lining the streets heading towards Buckingham Palace. Buckingham Palace is big, and that area is pretty large along the Mall and Parliament Square and all of that. But you see those pictures, and it is just unreal.
Yeah.
And to see the image of the king and queen out there, you know, greeting the crowd, you see the future Queen Elizabeth, she's there. She and her sister Margaret go out into the crowd later that day and celebrate, something I wish the Crown had covered. Is that moment, I mean, Queen Elizabeth has said in interviews that was the most memorable event outside of, you know, like the birth of her kids and her marriage to Philip and things like that. In terms of her public life, VE Day is something that she said she will never forget.
I bet.
And Churchill is a part of all that. Do you know if he actually went out into the crowds the way, or is he too public a figure to do that? Because he spoke to the crowds in the morning, then he goes down to Buckingham Palace, appears on the balcony, then comes back and gives that second speech that you talked about. Was he ever with the people?
Yeah, he was. I think he was the same man he was during the Blitz, where he would go to air raid shelters mm-hmm. and cry with the people.
Yeah.
And people would see his tears and say, he really does care about mm-hmm. us. He really is on our side. And they were genuine tears. Winston Churchill cried, not a lot, but when he was passionate about something.
He tends to blub, as he said.
He tends to blub. Yeah. Yeah. And so he was the same man then, and mm-hmm. why wouldn't he go out and celebrate?
And then, 3 months later...
He's voted out.
He's voted out of office. Like, they're tired of the Conservative Party, they were tired of him personally, what was the...
So, a few years earlier, there was a report that was put out, it was a very popular one, I'm trying to remember the name of it, but it spoke to the need for a welfare state.
Yeah.
And that took hold.
During the war.
It was during the war, in the midst of the war, and the reality of people losing everything and believing we need help to reconstruct everything back, that's one of the reasons why it was so prominent.
Yeah.
So people were carrying that baggage forward into it. And there's a belief, too, that Churchill didn't help himself. People cite the BBC interview where he talked about the Gestapo.
He was saying the Labour Party would do that.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
He said the Labour Party, they would have basically Gestapo agents. If they get a national healthcare system and a welfare state, they'll need that to monitor all of you.
Yeah, so I definitely side with Roberts on this. The English people knew who Churchill was.
Mm-hmm.
So they knew who he was, and they would have probably taken a statement like that in context to who they knew him to be. So I don't believe, I think he's right. I think Roberts is right when he said in his book, I don't believe that that hindered him. I don't think that
really?
That was like a major, okay. major thing. I spent a lot of time reading different accounts of this.
Yeah.
There's a select group of historians who say, well, actually that was really, really harmful for him. Yeah, it's harmful if we hear it, but we weren't with Churchill during all of the things that he would speak to them about, encourage them for.
But you've got to remember, and I'm not necessarily disagreeing with you, but by July, the first films of the Holocaust victims are out. The first eyewitness accounts of what the Gestapo had done during the war, those are also out. You don't think that in the minds of some people, and again, he's not accusing Germans of doing it. He's saying that my partners during the war... the Labour Party, that they will do this to you. You don't think that had at least some
impact?
It
probably had some, but okay. I don't think that it was the turning point for why he lost.
Okay.
I think the larger issue was people wanted things reconstructed, and they believed that the welfare state was going to achieve that.
Okay.
And Churchill was not a proponent of the welfare state.
So he's out for 6 years.
Yeah.
Clement Attlee, his former deputy, friend of long standing, who he had a lot of political disagreements with, he's the leader of the opposition, opposite benches in Parliament. Then he's back in 1951, and he serves another 4 years. What were the major accomplishments of that second ministry? And you mentioned in the quote, you said he was more, or someone, Jock Colville, his private secretary, said that he was more Buddha than Achilles. What does that mean?
He still had a direct style, but it wasn't as active politically as he had in the past to drive towards outcomes.
Was it that, or was it because there was no national emergency that unified the country, people didn't necessarily listen to him?
I think the national emergency made him what he was. So without that there, I don't know what else he could be.
Okay.
Yeah.
So he was still the bulldog, but you had other...
With no teeth, I guess.
But you had other political interests... Mm-hmm. who are now pulling, you know, in different directions.
There was no longer the singular focus.
One way.
Yeah. There was no longer that singular goal. It was now a lot of them.
Yeah. So is it fair to say that his second ministry was not particularly consequential?
I guess I would ask you, like, what do you, when you're teaching your classes about this time, how do you describe it?
Well, we stop with World War II in my world history class, so we don't cover this period.
Okay.
I will say... like you said, without that singular focus, it was pretty inconsequential.
Mm-hmm.
He did early on shape the instruction and the experience of Queen Elizabeth in her first, because she was, he was her first prime minister. You got to imagine, like, again, talking about British politics then and now, she's had, what, I think 14 prime ministers? It's kind of incredible.
You know,
from Churchill to now to Boris Johnson.
Absolutely is.
I like how you describe Churchill as just as a lock is made for a certain, or just as a key is made for a certain lock. Churchill was a man made for a certain time. Destiny is often used, applied, the word destiny is often applied to people by revisionists, by very hagiographic biographers and things like that. Do you think, honestly, that there was a sense, what you might say, a touch of destiny, to quote Pirates of the Caribbean, about...
Way to bring in that.
About Winston Churchill.
I do. I absolutely do. And I don't think it was... He was not a passive man. I think that every skill and book and poem and everything that he did, he always believed it was for some higher purpose that he would eventually fulfill. And he was very clear on that, even as a teenager. He believed that. And did that create the purpose for him? Did that create the outcome for him? Maybe. Maybe it had a hand in it. Maybe it was obviously the driver that got him to where he was, to be in the right moment at the right time to become PM. He was, we've said this several times, he seemed to be a man out of time, where his quirky, jovial personality was made fun of. It was ridiculed. It was seen as out of place. It was brash. It was strange, until it wasn't. Until it was exactly what everyone needed in the moment that they had to have it. And thinking back on it, and I'm being serious here, I look at this man and what he accomplished in his life, and I know the format of our show is what it is, to keep this brief, but there's no way I could succeed at trying to summarize everything that he was and everything that he tried to be. As I said last week, just a very special thank you to Andrew Roberts for his book, Churchill Walking with Destiny. And also, if you get the audio version, special thanks to Stephen Thorne, who, through his reading, created an experience where the reader is fully immersed in the history of the time and in the person of Churchill. You feel like you're walking with him and he's talking to you. He does a great Churchill impression, which I didn't dare try and imitate. And by the end of it, you're so overwhelmed with who the person was that when he does finally die and it's over and the book ends, you feel like you've lost a friend. In thinking about the analogy of the key and the lock, he was a man fit for the specific time that he rose to power, and he exercised every skill he had to do his best to create an outcome that would save his people.
Thank you for joining us in our discussion of Fulfilling His Destiny. I'm John Streeter.
And I'm Joe Parker.
Be sure to leave us a review wherever you listen to this podcast. It really does help. Thanks, and we'll see you next week.